You're listening to the Classic Comedy Film Podcast. This episode, I discuss the 1965 cult comedy The Loved One with my friend Trey Lawson. I want to apologize for the quality of this cast. I had some internet trouble on Skype, and there was some distortion. Also, there was a delay in getting this cast out because of a software problem I was having, but that's been fixed. So thank you for your patience, and on with the podcast.
I had never seen this before. I'd heard the title before. And I'm familiar with the author of the book that it's mostly based on.
But you hadn't read the book, am I right?
Right, no, I've not read it. I've read some other Evel Waugh stuff.
Uh-huh.
Not.
This one's a little different.
But yeah, no, I thought it was a lot of fun, actually. I wasn't sure what to make of it at first, but it's a really smart satire, I think.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those movies where it's almost like you have to prepare people because there's nothing conventional about it, and you have to know your audience, because there are people I know who I go to movies with who I know would hate this movie.
But I could definitely see that.
I have to tell you, the first time I saw this movie, I was, I think, 12 or 13, so I didn't understand a lot of the comedy in it.
Right, right.
And I know I watched it with my parents, which was a bad choice to watch that movie. Because they, I don't think, liked it at all.
Okay, yeah.
But then I saw it again in college. We showed Tom Jones and this movie in the film series that was at our school. And it was interesting, the response to that movie, because people go into Tom Jones thinking, this is sort of a strange adaptation of a classic book. And then they see this and they're like, there's nothing stranger than this movie.
Yeah.
So
the one thing that I kept thinking of, especially toward the end, with Jonathan Winters, when he goes on his sort of rant and the statues and all that, for reason, I kept thinking of Ned Beatty and Network.
Ned Beatty and Network is a great comparison. Actually, Network's a great comparison to this movie.
Yeah. I mean, there were moments throughout where that movie sort of came to the surface for me.
The thing that always strikes me about the movie is it feels almost like two different movies. There's the part that takes place when he first gets to California and he's sort of in Hollywood, and then there's the second part that takes place in the cemetery. And
yeah, I keep waiting for them to come back to the actor with the southern accent.
Yeah. Who I really love in that movie. I think he's a hilarious cameo to have in that film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, I have to say, I think I laugh more at the stuff in Hollywood than I laugh out loud at the stuff in the cemetery. The cemetery stuff gets really weird.
And it's a lot darker.
Yes.
It's very dark comedy.
Yeah. Where the Hollywood stuff is so much more of a satire on just the excess of Hollywood and California and the way people just get used and thrown away.
Right.
So, yeah. And John Gielgud kind of, you know, it's such a sad performance in that movie.
Yeah, yeah. And even at that point, there are just so many familiar faces who pop up for a few seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The one that jumped out for me was when they're at the club of the English expatriates, and Ellen Bigger is there.
Yeah. My favorite, I think, is Roddy McDowell.
Yeah.
as the somewhat head of the studio, I always think he's kind of doing a Richard Zanuck performance in a way. You know, that sort of the son of the studio head who's getting a lot more because he's the son of the studio, but he's still trying to make his way, and he's so vicious at parts in that movie.
That's how pointed it was that they always called him Junior.
Yeah. The junior part, and I think it always kind of makes me laugh, because if you know anything about Roddy McDowell, he got tossed away when he was really young in Hollywood, you know, as being, you know, he's not cute anymore, so he can't be a child star, and then came back. And this was around the time period that he was coming back to Hollywood. So I think there's a delicious pleasure for him in playing this character, you know, of everything that Hollywood does to people and sort of dehumanizing them. But John Gielgud just sort of breaks my heart in that movie.
So that comes back to what you were saying. It's like there's a whole other movie hidden in there that you don't really get.
Yeah.
Like, only ever get hints at sort of what he's been doing in Hollywood and what his motivations are and everything.
And it's almost the way that The Simpsons always have that, you know, the first scene, but it's not really anything to do with the plot. You could just say, this character's coming to California for a funeral. And it would be the same basic premise, because the premise of the movie is very much about the cemetery and death and the business of death.
Yeah, and it's something about that. It's, I just wonder if we're supposed to make some sort of connection between Hollywood and the cemetery. Mm-hmm. Because there's sort of this duality in everything in the movie. Like, even Jonathan Winters is playing twins, and there's two sides to everything. So I kept wondering if maybe there was supposed to be a connection there that I was not thinking about during the movie.
Well, and Jonathan Winters, one character is, you know, he's been fired from the Hollywood system, and now he's going to go work for a funeral. And I always think that there's an element of, because of the way that that funeral home is set up, that there's these roles, and there's the makeup artist who almost acts the way a makeup artist in Hollywood would act, that I'm thinking, like, he's being relegated to the B studio, but he's being relegated to the pet cemetery of this organization.
Right.
So what I think Jonathan Winters is sort of the big astounding thing in the movie. He's such a revelation to see those two performances. What did you think of them?
I thought it was fantastic. And at first, because the first time you see his other character, he's in the helicopter, he's sort of in the shadows, and it took me a second to realize it was him again.
Yeah.
But I thought he was great. And like I say, the thing that I thought of toward the end was at Beatty and Network, but and I guess I'd never seen Winters go that dark before.
No, I think that may be the darkest I've ever seen him in a movie.
Because when I think of him at that age, I think of things like the Mad World.
Uh-huh.
I've seen some of his later stuff that he's done, but that was just a really interesting turn for him, I thought.
It was funny because I think, like, the day I watched the movie again was the day that the whole Scientology thing was back in the news. So my ear was kind of paying attention to the whole thing. And it was reminding me of, like, this cemetery is essentially a cult, you know, which I had never really picked up on before. I knew it was a ridiculous statement on the business of death, and, you know, they mentioned Forest Lawn Cemetery in the movie, but I never really thought about the fact that everyone except Jonathan Winters' character really does seem to believe in the cemetery as a holy institution and a church almost. And, you know, they talk about it the way cult members would talk about their church, you know, that it's, you know, he's the master, and it's really disturbing. Right,
except our introduction to the whole thing is that tour guide at the monument who's, like, selling reproductions of the statues and making it this very sort of commercial thing.
Yeah, and the speaker with the master's voice over it is almost chilling to think of. Did you catch who that guy was, the tour guide?
I think I missed it.
It was Tab Hunter.
Oh!
There's all sorts of cameos in this movie.
Yeah. That's one I missed.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I love, besides Winners in the performance as, you know, the master and then his brother, who's sort of, you realize he really doesn't have any idea on some of what's going on. I love Rod Steiger's character
as Joy Boy.
Oh my gosh. He's so insane.
And once you go to his house and his mother is there, and it's just, it's like a third movie that shows up. Because that takes things to a whole other level of weird I wasn't prepared for.
Yeah, it seems like it comes out of nowhere that the stuff at the home, in both of their homes, is almost like a gothic horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mother character and this sick relationship he has with her, which is, you know, bordering on Norman Bates type relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And although I have to say, the part that cracks me up to the part that I laugh out loud even if I'm alone is the scene when he's in the kitchen and he's singing that song. But it's...
Oh, with the lobster?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, this is the strangest movie I've ever seen. And then you go to her house, and I always forget her name, so I have to just pull it up for a second, because she didn't do a lot after that.
Oh, Anjanette.
Yes, Anjanette.
Comer. I just looked it up. It's, yeah. Anjanette Comer.
Yes. And, you know, I don't think she had done anything in terms of mainstream Hollywood when she did this movie. And then she's playing this character who is convinced of the cemetery and the religious elements of it. And you go to her house and she's living on a cliff. Like, she's just,
yeah,
waiting to die. And she has that swing, and that scene when she's flying over the cliff is,
yep,
a startling image to just create. And it looks like it's out of a completely different movie.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking fairly early on that her character is someone who's right on the edge. And then they go and literally put her right on the edge.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's, you know, and you can hear the cracks, the rocks falling down.
Mm-hmm. And Robert Morse's facial expressions during that scene as it continues to shake are just priceless.
Exactly. And in a way, she is the most sympathetic character in the entire movie. She's,
mm-hmm,
the only sympathetic character at points, because, you know, Robert Morrison is not that sympathetic. He's actually kind of, he's ambivalent to a lot of what's going on.
And yeah, well, he's incredibly manipulative throughout.
Yeah, I mean, he literally says he's just coming to live off of his uncle, basically. The story begins with, I'm just going to stay with my uncle. You know, doesn't even give his uncle the opportunity to say no. And he spends,
right,
the rest of the movie just trying to either make money off the cemetery or get out of the country so that he doesn't get in trouble for what he's done.
Right. Well, and even his entire relationship with her is built on lies and manipulations.
Mm-hmm. But did you happen to see, I don't know if you rented the DVD, did you see the making of featurette that they included on it?
No, I didn't watch that.
I watched it just to get a little more information. He dubbed the entire movie.
Really?
Yeah, that entire movie is dubbed, his lines, because he had never done an English accent, and he kept going back into his American accent, and they just finally said, here's the script, you're dubbing the whole movie.
Wow, that's really ironic, considering the opening scenes.
Right.
That are about an actor trying to do a British accent.
Yeah. He should have trained with John Gielgud.
Should have.
Although, I love the dubbing. I love the scene when he's actually giving his demonstration of what he's learned for the English accent, and it's horrible.
Yeah. Every couple seconds, I would hear one word that actually sounded almost right, and then he would flip back to Southern accent.
You know, and just to do a whole nother trippy thing, that actor, who is a very good actor, is also a dialect coach in Hollywood today. And he teaches a lot of Hollywood actors how to do European accents.
That's fun. That's really fun.
And that accent is as far from his accent as you can possibly get, that Southern accent he's doing. Mm-hmm. It's like there's layers all over the place. So, was there any scene that really stuck out for you in terms of, wow, that is, either that was a great scene or that was a really bad scene in the movie?
One of my favorite scenes probably was, it was really sort of the moment where I realized just how weird the movie was starting to get, was when Robert Morse's character goes to the cemetery for the first time, and Liberace is the policeman.
Yes, Liberace doing the casket sales is pretty amazing.
And that was where it started to skew darker and weirder, and that was where I couldn't stop laughing during that scene.
I would have to say that the two scenes I really love in the movie are the scenes with John Gielgud and Roddy McDowall, because I think that they are really mean, and he's so indifferent to John Gielgud, and I have a soft spot for John Gielgud and Roddy McDowall, so that only helps my appreciation of that scene. But I
did leave that section of the movie wanting more with those characters.
I know. You want the prequel. And I also really love the scene when Jonathan Winter's character finally starts to explain to
Anjanette. Character is Amy.
Amy. He's explaining to Amy what he's planning to do with the cemetery now that it's filled up. And right. The images of these religious figures start to go into sexual figures. That is the darkest scene in that movie, I think, because it is throwing everything Amy believes in her face, you know?
Yeah, that's a really powerful scene. Even up to that point, even when it went dark, it was comic dark, but that sort of went beyond just dark comedy, I thought.
I think it's sad, honestly, because she really...
Because he's basically crushing everything that she thinks she stands for.
Yeah. And then you have the great scene right after that when she's talking about how she's been writing to this advice columnist, and the advice columnist turns out to be just an alcoholic guy who finds her letters either annoying or humorous to him.
And all of his responses have just been sort of a joke.
Mm-hmm. And you think she has nothing left in her life. She has no belief of anything in terms of religious, what life is like, what love is like. She just has no concept anymore. And she's just this completely lost soul. So, and then it's very sad when she goes and meets her end, which is, I find, a really sad scene in the movie. It actually
it is.
Yeah. When she paints her face and goes and lies in the casket. Ugh. Horrible.
Yeah. I think in its own way, Morris's character's sort of decision on what to do with her after that is the only halfway touching thing that he does in the whole movie. Even though it's totally secret, he's the only one who knows that it's really been done. It's not a moment of redemption, but it's probably the one good decision I think he makes in the whole movie.
And I think it's the one non-selfish decision he makes.
Right. Well, except for taking the money.
Yeah.
Which is selfish.
One of my other things that I really like about the movie is the discussion of what... There is this realistic discussion of what do you do with all of these cemeteries once they're filled up. It is a legitimate question that they're asking. They're asking in the worst way because they're literally saying, well, once it's filled up, we just pave over it and put something else here. But then right. You do think, well, what is the point of these burials? You know, we're filling up land with the deceased and making it precious land, but only precious land for as long as you can, and then you either pave over it or start again. It is an interesting question that they're asking. They're asking in a humorous way, but I think it's a legitimate thing that they're asking about. Why do we make cemeteries these holy places when it is just burial?
Right.
And as it turns out, it's also just business.
That's the thing, is that it's only holy so long as there's money to be made.
Mm-hmm. And he's completely... He has no concern whatsoever about what people have made this place important. They've created this as a tribute to their loved ones, and he sees it only as a financial institution. He's like the worst... He's the worst funeral director in the world. But, yeah.
And in true sort of early 60s space age style, they hit on perfect solution.
With the little boy played by Paul Williams,
which when he showed up, I'm pretty sure I did a double take.
And he's like 20 years old in that movie. But he's playing a 12-year-old.
He looks so young.
I know, and his voice is so high.
Yeah, and well, he still looks young to this day.
I know. I can remember watching this movie with my mom, and she was not enjoying it at all. And then he shows up, and she goes, "Is that Paul Williams?" He's like a child. And, I mean, his idea of blasting people off in the space would be the great tribute to people of this generation is hilarious, but I bet you could have sold people on that in the 60s, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, with celebrities, it does get done. So, I mean, that was the thing with James Doohan, who played Scotty on Star Trek, his ashes were launched into space.
And is it that much different from some of the crazy stuff like let's freeze people's heads or cryogenic, you know? It's just these weird approaches to burial that we've created. And although the connection between the pet cemetery and the human cemetery is pretty, that gets pretty dark too, but in a less overt way, you know?
Yeah. Well, and for me, the darkness there, or the weirdness there, was in the depiction of people's attachment to their pets.
Yeah.
Like with the wife who pulls the gun. And
she wants
that,
to
that
go.
That just got really weird for me.
But then, I mean, that scene is actually kind of a weird one because it's dark, but then something about Milton Berle's performance in it strikes me as much more old-fashioned comedy.
Yeah. I did get a little bit more of a screwball slapstick tone from him.
Mm-hmm. But then when he comes back from picking up the dog, the dead dog, you find out that they are treating these animals that they're supposed to be burying or cremating like garbage. You know, they're putting them in the refrigerator and they're not making any attempt even to show respect to these animals that they've been paid to take care of.
Just going back to a little bit before that, the way that Morse's character gets fired at the pet cemetery is just weird to me. And he gets pulled aside at Gielgud's funeral.
Right. And the other thing that always strikes me as weird, and I don't even know if it fits, is the scene when he's reading that tribute to his uncle, and it doesn't make sense to me why he would read it, because it's like, well, wait, you did write it, didn't you? I mean, where did that speech come from that you knew was inappropriate to write?
Right.
It was like, did you write it as a joke? Do you not actually think that people should have eulogies? What was... It seems out of place in the movie, because they don't explain it. It seems like there's a missing scene.
Yeah, the only thing I could get out of that was just the fact that he's actually supposed to be a really terrible writer.
He's the worst poet in the world.
Yeah, well, because the only way he's even able to court Amy is by pushing other people's poems, mm-hmm. which only works because she doesn't know enough poetry to gain it.
Exactly. And he is a pretty terrible poet.
Yeah.
He is horrific as a poet. Were there other scenes that you didn't like in the movie or thought were problematic for the movie?
I wasn't sure if it was entirely necessary. The scene after they decided to launch the astronaut's body into space, and so they go to get the permission from the woman at the club.
Right.
And that scene I know that I would say I didn't like it. It just felt really out of place. Like, they'd gone off on yet one more tangent. And at that point, I knew we were running out of movie, and then we're going to have to come back pretty quick. So, I don't know. That scene just felt out of place to me.
Ironically, I'm going to have to agree that that is the one scene that, for me, not only I don't find that it... I find it slows the movie down.
Yeah.
And I think I almost fell asleep and had to rewind the movie when I got to that part, because I was engaged in the movie when they're having that conversation about what are they going to do and meeting with the general and realizing that they can do these launches into space. And then I woke up and I was in the middle of Amy's breakdown, and I realized I had fallen asleep during that meeting with the widow. And I'm like, mm-hmm. This scene shouldn't take place at the end of the movie. There's something about having a lagging scene at the end of a movie that always bothers me.
And there is information given during that scene, which is funny, like the actual circumstances of his death and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like by diverting so far from that other action, you sort of lose the joke.
Also, I would say you could have... The anecdotal information about how he died, which is funny, I agree, could have been done as just the general saying, oh, well, he happened to die this way, you know.
Right. That could have been part of the scene just before where the generals all go to their orgy in the coffins.
Exactly. Which is also a really strange scene.
It really is.
I don't laugh at that scene because I think I'm always in shock, and I always forget it's in the movie because it's so random, and I'm always
and
like...
Isn't that Dane Andrews is one of the generals?
Yes, it is.
That's awesome.
And I'm always like, what would the orgy do to convince these people to do this? it's such a weird section of the movie. I don't dislike it, but I always get confused by it.
Yeah, well, and I think that's the beginning of the diversion that sort of takes us all to the strip club, and which I think that whole section just takes too long. It could have been done in a short scene.
Mm-hmm. And ironically, they spend so much time on this whole issue of the right to launch people into space so that they can have the land. And in reality, it's not Jonathan Winter's story, really. Although he's both his characters are major. And it's not Robert Morris's character, who's the main character. I mean, it's sort of a bait and switch. It's Amy who is the main character in the movie. And then when we go back to Amy after all that has happened, we've kind of lost place of...
Right, and so what we're left with is we know a whole lot more about what's going on than Amy does.
Right. And then Amy finds out anyways.
Yeah.
So then we get another thing of, this is what I'm going to do with the cemetery, that throws her into a tailspin. And I love that scene, but I feel like it takes too long to get from this is what we're going to do to explaining what we're going to do, and we lose track of Amy and Dr. Joy Boy, yeah, who are the two characters who I'm kind of most personally invested in their lives.
Right.
Yeah,
it does a really odd job of balancing the ensemble. Like you said, Amy, at least emotionally, is sort of a central character, and yet for so much of the movie, she's both not there and not really relevant to the discussion.
Exactly. And that is, I think, the one reason why I don't personally rank the movie as high as, you know, some other classics, is I feel like it's very uneven at parts.
Right.
I feel like the decision to do the 25 minutes or so in California and not really ever tie it back, even though those are meaty scenes, and the decision to have so much towards the end deal with this decision by the general and the master, while interesting, could have been done a lot faster, and we could have gone back to our two main characters, because I do feel those are our two main characters in terms of the audience's connection to what's going on.
Right. I agree with that. There were times, though, where when it was at its funniest and at its sort of maybe not darkest but weirdest, where it almost reminded me of like a early Richard Lester comedy or something.
An early what?
Richard Lester.
Richard Lester.
Yeah. Just moments where, and probably the moment that I liked best, sort of reminded me of something he would have done at around that period.
In a weird way, I never thought of Richard Lester as being a connection to it, but I always think of this movie kind of as the necessary film between a movie like Duck Soup and a movie like the movies John Waters made. You know, it's like something needed to come in the middle, and this is one of them.
Yeah, I can say, I see that, totally.
There's a real randomness to the movie that I think is very... And there's parts where there are literally bits that you never go back to, like the Milton Berle stuff.
Right.
It's just a bit. It's just an old-fashioned comedy bit that could have been in a TV show. But then there's also this grossness to the movie sometimes, this grotesque quality. I mean, mm-hmm. The mother character could be something out of the John Waters movie.
Yeah, that was actually what I first thought of when you said John Waters, all of the stuff with Joy Boy and his mother.
Yeah, it's very vivid, that stuff.
He brings the pig right next to her bed, they're gorging themselves.
Ugh, that gorging scene almost makes me sick. And I was, I had gotten home and I was eating my dinner, and I forgot about that scene, how close it comes. And I was like, I can't eat my salad anymore. wasn't like I was eating a piece of bacon or something. I was just like, this is kind of grossing me out. Did you take a look at some of the credits on the movie?
As far as the production credits? Yeah. Or, I asked Wexler.
Yeah.
Which I thought was amazing.
And then I always loved the fact that Christopher Isherwood was one of the screenwriters on the movie.
Really?
Yeah, and Terry Southern was the other one. That seems like the perfect person to adapt Evelyn Waugh novel. And if you know anything, I mean, Christopher Isherwood is the writer of the source material for Cabaret. And there is an element of that same view of the world that comes out loud and clear in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Hal Ashby was the editor.
Interesting. I didn't realize that either.
And I look at the scene with the swing and the house on the cliff, and for some reason it kind of reminds me of something that you could have seen in like Harold and Maude.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, in general, what did you think of the movie?
I enjoyed it. I found it funny. I don't know that I found it. I don't know that it's one I would come back to very often.
Mm-hmm.
But the weirdness of it is entertaining for the most part. Except for a few scenes where I thought it dragged, it never lost me. I was always able to sort of keep up with it and enjoy the humor of it. But yeah, I think if there is a weakness, it's that it sort of peters out at the end.
Mm-hmm. It was called, I think it was pretty happily promoted as the most offensive movie ever made, or a movie that would offend everyone in some way. Do you think?
Yeah.
Do you think it's true?
Maybe back then. Because I think at this point, comedies both on film and television have pushed the envelope so much further that I think very little of what's in there would be controversial now. I'm not sure about 1965, but I mean, you could watch a 30-minute episode of South Park and probably offend more people in America.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think South Park has done a pretty good job at making sure they offend people every now and then.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I find it offensive, because I think, and maybe it's just my view of the world and your view of the world is a little bit more, I don't want to say liberal, but a little bit, some of the things that they're satirizing maybe then, which would have been controversial,
I guess part of it would be how high a pedestal you're putting things like the funeral industry on.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I caught on early enough to where they were going with that, that it didn't offend me. I saw it as satire and enjoyed it as such.
Mm-hmm. I think I don't find it offensive, but I do find it shocking still. I think I still find there are scenes in the movie that I honestly, either I forget the magnitude of them, or even now when I think of that, I'm kind of like, that was strange and kind of grotesque. You know, there's actually, I think, kind of grotesque scenes in the movie.
Grotesque is a good word for it. I like that. That's both in terms of the characters and the content.
Yeah.
There's a lot of grotesque.
Yeah, I think there's scenes with the master. You know, like I said, that scene when he's taking the religious figures and turning them into sexual objects.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're not religious, I think that there is an element to that scene where it's so
because you like Amy, and you know that this is sort of almost torturing her to see this, you do feel bad that it's happening, even if you don't believe in religion, or you think that it's sort of, you know, that putting religion or death on a pedestal is wrong, you don't want her to be as hurt, because she is the one character I think you kind of sympathize with.
Right. Grotesque and cynical, I think, would be another word for, especially with Morse's character and the way that it approaches the business side of things. It's a very cynical approach to this subject matter.
Yeah. And he's not... I mean, that's the other thing, is he is... We've literally been given our main character, and he is such an unlikable main character that it was, I think, probably pretty shocking in 1965 to have a main character who is that kind of amoral, I would say.
Right. You don't really get a protagonist in the traditional sense.
Not at all.
Because even Amy is too much of a non-actor in terms of people taking action in the film. Like she doesn't have agency.
No,
in the way the other characters do.
She's the victim.
Right, right. You have a victim, but you never really have a protagonist come and save her.
Ooh, yeah. There's no saving Amy.
Yeah.
I always find this interesting that this was Tony Richardson's follow-up to winning for Tom Jones. Like, he was at the height of his career, he could do any movie he wanted, and he goes, I want to do this movie. And I want to make it as weird and nonsensical at times and as offensive as I possibly can. And he accomplished it.
Yeah, I wonder, do you have any information on how well it did at the time?
I know that I don't think it did incredibly well when it came out. I think that it later got kind of this cult status, similar to the way that I think a John Waters movie does. But the fact
I see it gaining that sort of following.
Yeah. Mid-70s, I think, was really when the movie started to gain steam as sort of a cult movie. But I don't believe it did especially well. And there was actually, I think, talk among the studio of whether they wanted to release it the way that they did. Because they thought it was so offensive. So, where would you kind of rate the movie in terms of, usually kind of a 4-star type rating? Where would it come for you?
You know, I definitely enjoyed it. It's not a classic by any means, but I'd say I'd probably give it, 3 stars. And a lot of that has to do with the cast. The cast is great.
And even the performances, even the really brief performances, I find completely enjoyable just to watch.
Yeah. I mean, any movie that's willing to start off with a James Coburn cameo and never come back to him, it's going to get some bonus points from me.
That is one of those cameos, I don't know why, but I always find it kind of laugh-out-loud funny, because he's just in it, and he's so into the character that you kind of think it's going to be a character that has more purpose, but he doesn't. He's just there for a second.
Well, what it reminded me of was some of the cameos in John Landis films.
John Landis?
In the Blues Brothers, toward the beginning, when he's just getting out of jail, and who's the cameo? I can't can't think of the guys. I can't think of who it was now.
Like the guy who's handing him back his things?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that is a cameo, and I haven't seen that movie in so long. Like, man.
Frank Oz. It's Frank Oz.
Yeah.
And it's the same sort of thing. Like,
he's giving a performance.
Character.
Yeah, I mean, well, I love the cameos in Blues Brothers. We might have to do a Blues Brothers podcast, too, because I know that you and I have the same favorite, have one of our favorite lines from that movie, the, you know, orange whip.
Yeah.
But that's a Blues Brothers conversation.
That's right.
But I have to say, I would agree that this is, for me, a three-star movie. Because I think its inventiveness and, again, the performances make the movie really enjoyable to watch. And I think the chaotic quality of it and sometimes the fact that we lose steam towards the end makes it less of a classic.
Right.
But I mean, it's definitely a solid movie, and I think that there's a whole audience of people who like really weird. They want to see something they've never seen in movies before. There are visuals in this movie that you have never seen before.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who uses a lot of film in teaching, I'm trying to think of a way to use something from this movie in a class.
You should teach the book.
I should. I should. Well, and when I was looking it up, it says that it also uses a little bit of another book called The American Way of Death.
Yeah, and that is actually the book I read.
Okay.
I have to be honest. As much as I like Evelyn Waugh novels, I don't love this book. And I started reading it, and I kind of just lost patience with it. Mm-hmm. I should pick it up again and just give it a try, but it's written in the 1930s, so its cultural references are so completely different.
Right.
But The American Way to Die is all about the funeral business in sort of the 1950s, and it's much more of an expose on the business of dying.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that book is really an interesting book because I don't think that they've changed Mary very many things. I mean, you read about some of the stuff that they do then and the outrage that she has on it, and it's not that different. Yeah, you could... Oh, that would be interesting to show this movie in a class and just see, you know, the scene with the mother or something.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that stuck out at you for the movie, or just sort of you wanted to make sure to mention?
I mean, again, and this comes back to the cast, but even on top of the performances and the cleverness of some of the bits, was just the playing sort of name that cameo. And there are certain movies where that's always fun to do, and this is one of those movies.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a certain element of, now that film history has accounted for who was gay in Hollywood but wasn't out, this mm-hmm. movie is kind of remarkable to watch because it is like every... out in Hollywood but not out in the public actor kind of makes a little appearance in the movie, and it's interesting just to watch that because it's like Tony Richardson was really making almost a political point in casting all these actors that
right.
he knew.
Right, and it's one of those things where it was secret, but it was one of those really, really badly kept secrets.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it was actually, and it was really sweet because Tony Richardson, I guess, told Robert Morris when they brought John Gielgud in from London. He was like, make sure and be really nice to him because he's a great guy. Like, Robert Morris wasn't going to be nice to him, or, like, not other people deserve to be treated well. But I guess Tony Richardson really liked John Gielgud and just thought, like, the most of him. And he was just like, no, he's the best. Which I thought was really sweet, because there's something very sad about that scene. You know, there's, I think, sort of two really sad scenes. They're not funny. They never get back into satire, but the scene when John Gielgud leaves and looks on at the studio that he's been at for years, and there's the scene when Amy paints her face and dies. It's just...
Right.
They're classic kind of tragic images.
Right, and but those are the two moments that make it something more than just a weird, dark comedy, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, Trey, before we hang up, you have to mention your blog and where people can follow you.
Okay. Well, I keep my blog on celluloidsheet.wordpress.com, and it's just the files dream of celluloid sheet. And you can follow me on @t_Lawson.
Awesome. And I'll make sure and put your follow information on the website and the podcast too.
Awesome.
Okay. Thank you, Trey, for watching the movie. Did you make your girlfriend watch it with you?
I did not. I watched this one by myself. I might have to have a party and get a bunch of people to watch it. This is one of those that I feel I need to share.
This movie and The Room would be a great double feature, wouldn't it?
That would be interesting.
Just weirdness upon weirdness, this movie would be.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for watching it. I'm so glad. And we will do another podcast soon, and I'll maybe we should do the Blues Brothers. That would be a fun one to do with you, because I think our quotes are kind of same in terms of our favorite ones.
Probably so.
Yeah, John Candy's my favorite in that movie.
He's pretty awesome. I'm a lot of people watch that movie specifically for the music cameos, but I watch for like the movie about cameos.
Yeah. Twiggy, Carrie Fisher.
Exactly. Spielberg, Frank Oz.
Well, we will do one soon, I promise. And thank you so much for watching and taking the time. I really appreciate you getting it, I'm assuming from Netflix or something.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, thank you so much.